Welcome to American Masters, Lennon NYC, Beyond Broadcast, our weekly podcast leading up to the November 22nd airing of our new documentary, Lennon NYC. I'm Susan Lacey, creator and executive producer of American Masters, and with me is Michael Epstein, the writer and director of Lennon NYC.
Hi, Susan.
Michael, tell us about this week's podcast.
This week is Jim Keltner, who is a really interesting guy. He was a drummer on a lot of John's solo work and a lot of George's solo work, and is a good friend of Ringo as well. Jim, for those who remember, in the 1970s, there was, I think it was on the back of George's album, was the Join the Jim Keltner Fan Club on their albums. And that was a sort of little dig at Paul McCartney, who on the back of Ram had put joined the Paul McCartney fan club, and George thought that was so atrocious. He on his next album, he put "Join the Jim Keltner fan club." And Jim's just a great drummer and was a very dear friend of John's. And as you'll hear, you know, recorded early on in Tittenhurst with John on the Imagine album, and then was on sometime in New York City, sort of an additional drummer with Elephant's Memory. Was one-to-one concert, and it was really, for us, exciting because he was in L.A. With John during that Lost Weekend period and hadn't really ever spoken on camera before about that whole stuff, and I think it's pretty interesting. He was there at the Troubadour the night with Ann Peebles, and so you're in for a treat.
Yeah, it's I've, of course, seen it, and it's an extraordinary interview. Well, thank you, Michael. Now, join us, please, next week when our podcast will feature our interview with Elton John. And don't forget the broadcast of Lennon NYC on November 22nd, 2010. As always, check your local PBS listings. And to learn more, go to pbs.org/American Masters.
You played in London with him first, is that right, or was it only in New York?
No, I played, the first time I ever played with John was in Ascot. At the house, and the studio was in the bedroom, or it was a former bedroom, and that was, but I met Yoko before I met John.
This was in Tittenhurst, today.
Yeah, right? Tittenhurst,
right.
Yeah.
So you met Yoko first, right, because of her
she was doing her Fly record, and, you know, I had no clue what it was at the time, but we had a great time that day. She was telling me, she was very descriptive, you know, and she was saying, I remember her telling Bobby Keys, the sax player, to take his mouthpiece out of the horn and see what that sounded like. And so Bobby was, you know, being very serious, as he should be, you know, and he took it out and he played a few sounds. He said, "Oh yeah, that's good. I like that. I want the sound of the wind blowing across a frog's back, all the way around the world, something like that." And I remember thinking, "Yeah, okay, I hear that." And Bobby, you know, did his bit, and she loved the fact that once she started talking like that, I knew what to do. So I put some drums on the floor and put tea towels over them, and played them sort of to simulate maybe tabla or something. So, and she loved that. So we got on right away.
You know, there is a sense with Yoko, especially at that moment, there's a lot of animosity towards her. Just people don't understand her, think of her. I mean, she talks about, you know, that she's a witch and she's controlling. This just, but again and again and again, everybody that is friends with her, that worked with her as an artist, has a radically different sense.
Well, she you know, that's the key to Yoko, is to understand that she is an artist. She was always an artist. She was an avant-garde artist. She was a New York avant-garde artist, basically. And if you know that, and you know anything about that world, then you wouldn't question a lot of the things she does or says, you know, you would realize where that's coming from. She's a very bold person, but that's part of her being that type of artist. She was always very bold and outspoken, but controlling over John, I saw instances, I saw too many instances with the two of them in the studio and outside of the studio where that was just definitely not the case. John wore the pants in that family, and very much so. She was very outspoken, and John loved her opinions. He loved her, you know, jumping in with stuff until he'd had enough, and then he'd, you know, he'd clamp it down. Now, I saw that many times.
All right, so let me talk a bit about John. So you go in, and how do you get in the orbit? Is it that you had played with Yoko?
Well, what happened with John? My involvement with John was I was staying at with Eric Clapton at his home in Surrey, Ewhurst, and I was there doing something with Eric, and we were meeting Stevie Winwood at Barnes, the great studio in Barnes, Olympic Studios. And so we would drive from Surrey to Barnes every day and go in and play. And they were writing as far as what I could, and I just worked with Eric. And we were talking a bit about that, and I think what I understood from what he was saying was that that was like maybe going to be a band. Now, I may be wrong about that. I'm not sure. In any case, I was there. And so I picked up the phone one morning, and it was Phil Spector. And he said, I said, I can't wake Eric up, you know, because I'm not, you know, I don't want to go up and wake him up. So, but I'll leave a message. And he said, well, let me ask you, do you want to play on John's record? And I said, yeah, I'll play on John's record. So I got a friend borrow his drums. You know, he picked me up, and I used his drums. He set them up for me. Everything was a wonderful thing. Colin Allen, great guy. And then...
So what was that moment like? You go into John's house, right?
Yeah.
Do you remember the scene?
Oh, I remember. I remember. I don't remember a lot of things, but I remember that evening very well. It wasn't an evening. It seems like an evening because it was very foggy that day. And we drove up in that little Mini Cooper, and I'm thinking, wow, just you know, this is going to be an amazing day. And
Was he cold? Was he warm? What was it like? I mean, Your Jealous Guy is the song you played on that day, right?
Yeah. The thing. The thing about it is that I didn't have my own drums, and I was playing in a little bedroom, and I had never done that before. I would come in this business, you know, the classic way of playing at United Western, which is turned into Ocean Way and all that stuff. So it was a very tiny little space, and I'm playing on these little Gretsch drums, and I was just hoping that, you know, that I could get the best out of myself, you know, for the songs. And sitting down and hearing his voice in the headphones and looking at him across the room with his headphones on and singing was so powerful that all of that just went away, and there wasn't anything but the song and him and me knowing exactly what to do because of the way he wrote songs and the way he sang. He was a very, very powerful songwriter.
What do you mean by that? I mean, in terms of the note, the chord progression, the words?
Just for me, a powerful songwriter. When I say powerful songwriter, I mean somebody that writes a song that if I'm involved in it, if I'm asked to play on that song, bring what I can to the table for that song is, if I find that song to be playing itself, that to me is a great song written by a great songwriter. Now, that's my criteria. I don't know, other people would describe it differently, but I've been very fortunate to have that experience with John Lennon and with Bob Dylan, two of the greatest, right? George was like that for the most part, and you know, a few others, but those three guys would be at the very top of my heap. And if you, and so I've told people for years, I've always said this, you know, playing with John was just, there wasn't anything to it. There could be 5/4 bars, 7/4 bars, and I never made out a chart with John. And I always had to have a chart in front of me because that was my security blanket. But with John, I never did. I would hear the song, and it's just like immediately you just know what it's going to be and what to do.
So give me some sense of his process. Is he looking for the song in the studio? How is he coming to the music?
John was just really, really classic in his way of making records. He came in to the studio with his guitar or at the piano. He would sit and sing the song and play it, and then he would yell out bits that he wanted somebody to pay attention to, and then he would say, the guitar will come in here. He would very rarely say anything to the rhythm section, me or Klaus, or Gordon, the other bass player, wonderful bass player. And but he would give a lot of direction to guitar players and to the keyboard players, if there were any on.
Because those are instruments he knew.
Yeah, that he played, and he wanted to, you know, specific things. He knew his arrangement that he wanted. He was very specific with his arrangements, but in a real classic way. I mean, it wasn't. And John was just a very, very strong force of a personality. So when he spoke, you listened. You know, you could be in the other room and you hear his voice. He's just such a distinctive voice, singing and just talking. And he had that great honker that in certain pictures you see, like went up from there, like down to here, and it seemed to appear to come straight down and then flare out. Right, like a bull, like a weird. It's a great honker, one of the great ones, and that's what your voice is. You know, I mean, that is the. You know, you have your mask. Everybody has their mask that creates their thing, but the honker is the one I think that gives you the personality, the detail of what your voice is going to end up sounding like, and that reedy sound that he had was just, hey, I mean, it'll be here forever. You know,
it's a voice. You know, it's very different than Paul's. Paul's is like a softer thing, and John cut. Like John, you could hear John's voice cut through the song.
Oh yeah,
right. I mean,
maybe
it's sometimes the way Spector mixed it or not, but he always sat in front. His voice sat in front, and he hated it. I guess. I mean, I've heard, you know, stories from George Martin saying that, you know, he wanted him to futz with his voice, but I just think it's just this clear.
Yeah. Well. Knife. That's interesting you say that, because John, that is another thing about John that was really influential on me, and had to be on everybody that ever worked with him, ever played with him, or ever spent any time with him. He always, and apparently, and I don't know because I wasn't there for the Beatles, but from what I understand, you know, from reading about the history and talking, you know, George would talk once in a while about those days, but not much. Ringo wouldn't talk really that much about it, and I never got a chance to talk to Paul about it. But John would be the least. He was the one that would talk least about the Beatles. He never really wanted to talk about the Beatles, not to me anyway. And
because he was burdened by it.
No, it wasn't anything. I don't think it was anything spooky or that, you know, that he just. You know, no, it was no vibe about it other than, you know, that's done, and I got other stuff I want to do now, you know. And I think he wisely was like that because, you know, it's part of history. If you want to know about that, read about it, you know. He can't afford to be telling everybody spending all of his time telling people what it was like. So the thing is that what I did gather from him, from what he used to do in the old days was, in those Beatle days, was he was extremely adventurous, and he never was happy or satisfied. He never was happy or satisfied with.
Can't control the air traffic. Scott, can you
about
the air traffic? Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Helicopters in Los Angeles? That's a.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so
living my neighborhood.
During the
so.
He was never satisfied.
Yeah, he was. He always wanted to. From what I've always understood, is that he never wanted his He never wanted his guitar to sound like a guitar. And he always wanted the drums to sound very different than the dry, regular sound of drums. And he probably was that way about his vocal as well. I don't know. But those two things affected me very deeply. And I have a tape. I have an archive of many tapes of things from back in those days and current days. People I work with that interest me, so I will get a little tape if I can before I leave, and or CD now. But this one tape I had when I was looking back at stuff, I ran across this one little area where John was talking to us in the studio while we were getting ready to record something. I have no clue what song it was, but I just remember him saying, well, I don't want to really repeat exactly the way he said it, but in essence, what he was...
If you give us the tape, that would be great, too.
Well, let me just say that what he was saying in essence was that he didn't like... He said, he was telling the engineer, don't give me one of those clean recordings. You know, I hate those clean recordings.
This is on New York City.
It might have been New York City.
It's on the New York City album, and it's the New York City song. I've heard a bootleg of this.
Yeah, did where he says that?
And he says something on the order of, "It's going to be all fucking clean when we're done. I hate that," or something.
Yeah, like that, right? Yeah, exactly.
Well, let's go.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Well, then that was all right. Maybe
he mean by that?
Maybe I didn't actually hear that on the tape. I may have heard that same bootleg, but anyway, that really describes it all. For me, with John, and what he means by that is even though he had a classic approach to making records and to delivering his songs to musicians to play and to make records, even though he had that classic approach, he was still he didn't want his records to sound like everybody's records on the radio at the time, which were very hi-fi and clean and done with very, very good advanced technological, like the best mics at the time, the best engineers, and you put all those things in line and you get a really great, what they would call a great hi-fi recording. John did not like that. He wanted to have something sound more like old Sun records or, you know, something from that era. Bob Dylan has always been like that. Bob has always wanted some sound closer to the past, to the old exciting records, the ones that Ahmet Erdogan and those guys put together, you know.
Didn't John always say, give me that Elvis effect?
Excuse me?
He would say, give me the Elvis effect, which is like the tape delay on his
Give me the stuff that they used back then. He did a lot of research on all that. And so that's what he meant.
Also is what he listened to. I mean, what he loved, right?
Well, sure.
What he loved was Carl Perkins. George is the same way, right? They loved rock and roll.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
Talk about the sound that John was looking for. What does that mean?
You know, John. Okay. Well, I hate to be a stick in the mud here on that, but I never recall John ever looking for a sound. What John would do when he would come in. I told this to Sean the first night I met him. In the studio, Sunset Sound. I said, we went in for a playback, and Sean was doing this immediately with the faders. And I said, man, that's exactly what your dad used to do. I just always assumed that. I always loved that he would do that, because the last thing in the world you're going to do is come in the engineer's domain after you have recorded this music and come in here and start messing with faders. You know, they would freak out completely. But it's John Lennon. And it's Sean Lennon, so no problem. I think he just loved to explore, see what would happen if you did this, if you did that. What happens if this is too loud or that's too whatever? You know, this is the way John got the sounds that he liked. John was not the type of guy to say, I want this kind of sound, or at least not that I recall. He would talk to guitar players, again, he would talk to them about their sound. But as far as saying I want the record to sound like this or something, I never heard any of that. John, I'm sure John knew exactly what he was looking for. Hey, you know, you forget, you might forget, but you should never forget that this is a guy who who produced the Beatles records. Okay, now you have George Martin, of course. George Martin is listed as producer, and for, rightfully so, because he was one of the great producers of our time. You know, he produced the Beatles. But he didn't just produce the Beatles song tracks and stuff, I mean, on his own. Those guys were brilliant. Those guys really knew what they were doing. So they produced themselves. George Martin, as I understand it, and this is what I was told by George and John both, that George Martin showed them the way in a lot of ways, and that they, you know, that they would have never been able to
help
do.
He
helped them see possibilities, and we also know that he was brilliant with his arrangements and all that other stuff. And whatever else he did, I don't know because I wasn't there. But we all know one thing: we love those records as much as we love anything by any master of music ever in our time. You know.
So you know, I was going to ask you. You mentioned very off the cuff a little bit about loving some songs on Sometime in New York City. It's not an album that was well received.
Yeah, and I can see why. It's rough. You know, it's a little rough sounding.
What do you like about it, or do you not? Have you?
I haven't heard that record in so long. I haven't heard any of these records in so long. Although I just heard Mind Games not long ago because a guy played it for me and wanted me to talk about it for a magazine. But
what was the impression when you listened to that album?
Oh, I loved it. It brought back immediately the feeling that I had when we did it.
Do you remember recording that?
Oh, I remember every little detail of it.
What was John's state of mind with that album? I mean,
well,
was he different than...
No, he was just at work. He would play these songs. What was great for me personally was that John, I loved seeing John be pleased. I mean, if you're a musician and you're playing on somebody's record, that's what you want. That's what you're there for, and you can only hope to be that, you know, in spades, and that's. And I always got that from him. That's why I ended up working with him for so long, you know.
Did you play on all the tracks on that album?
Yeah, I played on everything from I played on the two tracks of Imagine, and then Mind Games, Walls and Bridges, the rock and roll album, and, one of the songs Julian actually played drums on. And I played on all those at that time, so the point being that John, I think the reason why I had a nice little run there, you know, with that was because I was doing the job that he wanted. You know, he liked the way, like I said before, he always told me that Ringo was his favorite drummer. You know, so that we got that straight in front, you know. But he knew, I would ask him constantly about Ringo, you know, this and that. How did, you know, did you tell Ringo to do this or do that on this song or whatever? And he would sometimes answer me, but generally it would be a very cryptic kind of little answer, and like, let's move on, you know. Because he didn't really want to go into it much, but he knew how much, what a great effect Ringo's playing had on me and the whole world, you know.
Well,
Ringo is... Pardon me?
Nothing against you, Jim. But
why wouldn't Ringo be playing on his solo records?
Yeah.
Well, obviously because then it wouldn't have been a total solo record. It would have been part Beatle. And, you know, it just, you know, that's it. Then why not have George playing guitar, you see? So, you know, why have Spinoza or one of those guys, you know?
Right. Well, there is that specter that you've got, I mean, I don't know, Phil Spector, but there is that sense that they have a breakout. They at that period, they all had to sort of differentiate themselves from what had been, right?
Hey, I'm like everybody else, man. When I was playing there with John, I would just kept thinking, God, it would be so great if George and Paul were playing, and then I think, yeah, but then it wouldn't be the same with me. It would have to be Ringo. So I just always wanted them to get back together some kind of way, you know. And I would always be thrilled when I would hear some rumor about, hey, they're getting together, you know. But It was never true. It never even came close to being true, I think. Yeah.
But you played together that night in L.A., right, with Paul and John? Right?
Yeah. No, I never played with Paul and John together. They were never... I hate to say it, but that rumor is not true. Paul and John were never in the same room together, not with me. I never was with John and Paul together in the same room, ever. Ringo and Paul. And then Ringo left early one night, and Paul and I were jamming. Paul was playing on Ringo's drums, and right next to me, and we were flailing away, and he and Paul broke a stick, or he dropped a stick, and he reached over in my bag and pulled the first thing he could grab, which was a mallet, actually. So he's playing one of my mallets upside down on the backbeat. And he went through the head, the snare drum head on Ringo's drum, and I just freaked out. And we were done. I said, "Wow, you broke Ringo's." I said, "You broke the Ed Sullivan head." And he goes, "That's all right. I'll get him another one." And I just never forget that night. And it wasn't like me in those days to do things like, "Hey, would you sign this?" Well, I should have done it. But what I did instead was I put a little piece of tape taped it back together, and I wrote, "Paul broke this on the date." I still have it in my attic at the house. But
I like that you said that you broke the Ed Sullivan head.
Yeah, I said, "You broke the Ed Sullivan head, man."
Ringo's kit.
Yeah.
You broke the Ed Sullivan head.
Well, and you know, and those guys, see, that's another beautiful thing about Charlie Watts and Ringo Starr. Ringo, the drum set that he has... That he played on Rubber Soul and many of those great records, is in a warehouse in London, and it's that beautiful Ludwig wood, natural wood set, and it's got the same calf heads have been on there for all those years, and I love that as an example of how you should play the drums. You can play those drums sound as big and as powerful as any drum set you'd ever want to hear on those Beatle records. But he didn't do it so hard that he was athletic about it, you know, like slamming into it and crashing into it. You know, you don't have to do that with drums. Drums have a natural resonance. You just play firm and confidently with it and strong, and you can play loud, but... Only loud is only loud when there's quiet next to it. A constant loudness is so unmusical. And I say that at knowing that I'm, you know, some people will be offended by that because loud is good, you know. Loud, if you're talking about thrash metal, or if you're talking about Slayer, or if you're talking about or if you're talking about any band that Dave Grohl plays with, loud is good for me. Because I love the way he plays. I love the way certain guys can play loud drums. But not everybody can do it. Not enough guys can play really, really loud and be convincing. It's too laborious sometimes. You know, if you can play loud, really loud, like Dave Grohl can, and really still be thrilling and talking, having conversation, because drums is conversational. If you can still do that, then you got me. But if it's just... crashing, thrashing with, you know, where it's all it's, you know, is making drum sound choked, yeah. And then they have to try to pump them up. That's another story. But Ringo, those drums that he has, you know, they exemplify what I'm talking about. Yeah. Just to be able to look at them and go, "Wow, look at that. Those are the same heads that have been on there, and their calf on top of that. They're skin. They're not plastic. Mylar." And then Charlie Watts, the same thing. Charlie has the same bass drum head. On the batter side that he's had for 25, 30 years or longer than that. All those tours, all those great major Rolling Stone tours, same drum head.
That's crazy. All right, let's get back to John for a bit. So you do Mind Games. He's with Yoko still, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
He comes out to L.A.
Let's see. Mind Games... Mind Games, it might have been...
Mind Games is before it comes out, because when he's out here, he starts to work with Spectre, that falls apart, and then he makes Walls and Bridges.
Yeah, well, what happened was, you're right. he came to the house. We were still living in Silver Lake, as a matter of fact, on Maxwell. He and May, he was with May at that time, and they came out, and he brought an acetate, and that's what he played on my system, on my turntable that night. He played me Mind Games, and I freaked out. I remember saying, wow, you used that line, that high line, that high string line. I kept singing that all the time on the playbacks. And he said, yeah, you sang it so many times, I decided I would use it. I think I remember, actually, that he said I may do that at some point. Because every time I would hear that chorus, actually the verses. But anyhow, I was blown away by that.
I heard a version of Mind Games that starts off with Make Love, Not War, instead of Mind Game. Did he ever come to the studio with an unfinished song, lyrics that weren't quite there yet, and you would develop?
If he did, I wasn't aware of it. Because
right.
The only thing I ever remember was that the records were pretty much complete, you know.
So what's his state of mind with May? When did you get this? Did he talk to you about Yoko kicking him out? Was there a sense of where his personal life was like?
The only thing I know about that is what you know, you know. What everybody knows pretty much is that Yoko sent him away and said, you know, take May because she'll take care of you, you know.
But why send him away? What was?
Well, that I don't know. I really don't know. You know, I don't know. You'd have to,
we'll
you should ask
Yoko.
Somebody,
we'll
ask Yoko.
Yoko.
Yeah.
Say,
Yoko, why did you send him away?
Yeah. There is a sense, though, with John, because of that bad, and Mel talked about it, that, you know, John sort of thought that he was slipping, that his, you know, that sort of culture
yeah.
had passed him. Did you get that?
I never got that. I never got that vibe from him at all, ever.
Well, what was it like hanging out with him in LA? Did he ever talk to you about why he was here or what his state of mind was? Or did you ever wonder why he's not with Yoko? Why he's with May?
No, I just, like I said, I only heard the basic... I just heard the basic thing, you know, that everybody knows that they somehow or another they came to a conclusion that he had to get out, you know, take a break, basically. It's like when people separate, only, you know, two people like that wouldn't do it the normal, you know, separation way. You know, it would just, Yoko would say, here, May, go take him, get him out of here. And, apart from that, I really can't tell you any of the other bits except that when he was in L.A., it was just as magical for me as it was in New York, you know.
Was he a happy drunk?
You mentioned Yoko a moment ago. Now, I've told this to Sean, and I've told this to several people. What John did that was routine, seemed to be routine, when he got drunk, when he really got drunk, he would scream Yoko's name repeatedly. And one time that he did that was we were in the back of somebody's Cadillac, Spectre's Cadillac or somebody's Cadillac, and we were put back there with him. Jesse, the guitar player, and myself were... put back there with him to hold him down because he was trying to kick out the windows of the car. And so we were trying to hold him down, and he was just too strong. I mean, he, with one hand, actually, he pushed me to the bottom of the well in the back. And he was fighting Jesse off with his right hand and just screaming Yoko at the top of his lungs and still able to be kicking the window. we got up to Lou Adler's, and Jesse went in, but I went back with the driver. And I heard what happened the next day. He ripped up a palm tree in the front by the door. He ripped out all of his phones, apparently. He broke all the gold records. You know, it was just a crazy rage, alcoholic rage. But being John, who knows what it was behind it, you know. He's part Irish, isn't he? Very Irish English guy, and
he missed Yoko,
and he probably was, maybe he was frustrated that I think I did hear that he would call from time to time, and she didn't want him to come back quite yet, or something like that. I may be wrong about that. Maybe that's what angered him even more than, because he was frustrated that he couldn't go back where he wanted to be, you know.
Well, you look at the behavior and you understand why. She didn't want to go back to the rightly so, you know, the same.
Yeah, maybe so. I you'd have to ask somebody else about that.
So set the record straight if you can, because you were, I guess the one question I have is, you made it out pretty much unscathed. How is that, what was it about you that, you're the last man?
Well, I'm hesitant to say, to talk about my faith, and then other times I just go ahead and do it, and so. But it's too long of a story actually to tell you in detail. But I could just encapsulate it by saying, I was kind of plucked up out of this thing that I was doing. I graduated like everybody else from all the stuff that we were doing to very hard stuff and very dangerous things. And just before I could have slid all the way to the bottom, like everybody else was at that time. A lot of people were going and and losing careers and stuff and falling out of, just falling off away. And now we know, after all this time, a lot of people were developing what would be the way that they would die later on. Terrible throat and things and stuff. And so I was fortunately plucked up out of that. And there's a whole story behind all that, which it's another story and for another time. But that's basically what happened to me, and it didn't happen overnight. It was a long procedure. And
but did you participate in those nights with John? I mean, you went.
Oh yeah.
Talk to me.
Well, I wasn't there at. I wasn't there for the night that they were kicked out of the Troubadour. That was with Harry. And Harry, Harry and I were all good friends, and Harry was a big ringleader for all of us too. We got in a lot of trouble with Harry.
Harry
Nilsson was just one of the greatest cats you could imagine. John loved him more than anything. To know Harry was to completely just to love the guy. I mean, he was the greatest. He loved a party. He could really sing, and he could really he was such a musical. Artist, he just was great to play with in the studio and all, and John loved him very, very much. They all did, all the guys, all those Beatle guys did, and all the musicians all the artists who were songwriters, loved Harry Nilsson,
but
Harry partied too long, is what it was. He stayed too long at the party. Harry did, unfortunately, and so that took him down, but the night that you're talking about, one of the nights, the most famous night of that crazy period for John was when he put the Kotex on his forehead. Now, we were all at dinner at what was it called, the restaurant? I can't think of the name now. I used to know the name off the top of my head. No, it was a restaurant right on Larrabee, Lost on Larrabee. And so we were eating dinner, and me and Jesse Ed and my wife Cynthia and May and John, and I can't be sure of the rest of the people because I got a bit out of it myself that night. But we had dinner, and then we went downstairs to the men's room. The guys were, and then the ladies were going to go into the ladies' room. And John decided to go into the women's room. And so we thought it was funny And so he went in the ladies' room, and he came out with a Kotex on it, taped on his forehead. And so we're laughing hysterically, and we're egging him on, like, you know, oh, that's great, you got to keep it on. And the girls are all going, okay, it's funny enough now, take it off. But he wouldn't take it off, so we go upstairs, out on the street, we go down to the Troubadour.
And you've had a few drinks.
Huh?
You've had a few drinks.
Oh, we've had a few drinks, yeah. And then so we go into the Troubadour, and because it's John, they didn't question it, you know. They might have smiled or something, you know. But we walked on in. We sit around in this special place. You know, when you're with John, you know, you sit in a special place. And Ann Peebles was singing that night. And just, you know, it was like a normal, nice evening until he stood up and he said a couple of things that, you know, are unsayable here in front of the camera.
Unsayable.
Yeah, it's unsayable. For me, it's unsayable.
Okay. Give me a sense.
I could say it to you if we were sitting over in the couch by ourselves, but I can't say it in front of a lady, you know. but it's something we're all very familiar with. Anyway, so he stands up and he says this, and everybody's shocked. I'm not shocked because, you know, it's John and I'm, you know, we're in the same condition and all that, and we're laughing. But my wife is going like that to me, so I'm trying not to laugh. And then I realized it kind of was serious because people around them, they paid money to come and have a nice civilized evening listening to Ann Peebles. And they're seeing, you know, this guy that would have been fun to see probably if he had been really John Lennon. But no, he's John Lennon with a Kotex on his head and he's really out of it and he's, you know, being obscene. So so I realized the seriousness of it, you know. And then finally we got out of there. And they didn't kick us out.
Do you know who I am?
Yeah. That's right.
Is that true?
That's right. Yeah, that did happen. Well, no, that's all that happened. She came over.
Did she come over, right?
I think she was probably told by somebody, go talk to him.
Who?
Give me the telephone. Well, who knows? It might have been Doug Weston, the owner, maybe.
No, but who came over to you?
Oh, I think, no, it was just one of the girls, one of the waitresses. And she said, and I think what she said was, you know, something like, hey, you know, you're going to have to, like, chill or something. Please, you know, we got other people here and everything. And he said, don't you know who I am? but you have to know, you know, you have to think about all that in context. You know, John did that another time, too, one time when he was yelling, screaming really loud. And he was pulling my hair. I was trying to control him, and he was pulling my hair and pushing me and away. And I was, and he said, "Don't you know who I am?" And I said, "Yeah, I know who you are. Get the fuck off of me." And
so the waitress comes over.
Yeah, but so that was all that was. You know, the waitress came over.
And can you tell me the story? Because it's funny.
You know, I can't.
I can't.
Oh, yeah, that's right. You're an asshole with a Kotex on his head. Yeah. Yeah.
Let's go back.
That, I don't remember that.
You don't remember
but
that.
I read that. So I'm right. Sorry to say that's just, yeah, I don't remember hearing that.
Yeah.
I do remember that somebody came over and because my wife was very upset with the fact that I was laughing and having fun about it. You know.
But you get kicked out or just walk out?
No, we didn't get kicked out that night, no. You know, it was just, you know, he just got a little bit out of hand, you know. That's the way people were looking at it. I played one-to-one with him, and that was it.
That was
Madison Square Garden.
Yoko did her thing. He did his thing. People wanted to hear, you know, Imagine or I Want to Hold Your Hand, right? How did that go over?
I just remember that it was. I thought John did a great job. I thought Yoko did a great job, and the band, you know, was well rehearsed, and I thought it came off okay, but. I never was convinced that the audience, you know, saw it as John and Yoko the way they wanted to see John and Yoko. I think they didn't. I think the Elephant's Memory confused them maybe or something. They didn't, you know. I don't know exactly what they expected, but I think maybe that's what they didn't know what to make of the Elephant's Memory. They didn't know who the Elephant's Memory was, basically, that's all. But I remember thinking that musically it came off really good. I used to love, I loved Stan. I loved the way Stan played sax. He's fantastic. Rick was a really, really good drummer. The bass player was really great. I can't remember his name. The guitar player was really fantastic. I guess I don't know what they would have expected, maybe, you know, they wanted to be, of course, we all did.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, there's a video of John walking through Central Park in 1980 and people still shouting, when are you going to get back together?
You're going to get back together.
And he's like, when are you going to go back to high school?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, my sense is in some ways is that people were never quite ready for John and Yoko. Certainly not public-wise. I'm not talking about the people in his life.
Yeah.
Accepting.
I think you're right. I think, unfortunately, I think you're right. I think they never did want... They always wanted Yoko to be separate from John somehow. And John wasn't going to have that. And Double Fantasy, I think, fixed that. I think Double Fantasy was what... I think they were probably ecstatic that it was well-received and it was the two of them, obviously, and it was about their life. And now they're going to go on the road. I know Andy Newmark, the drummer, was... He was ready to go, man. He was set to go on tour. You know, it's like my good friend Sugarfoot was ready to go on tour with Michael Jackson. Bang, no more tour, no more nothing. I think that's exactly what happened with Double Fantasy. They peaked. They got right where they were. John got right exactly where he was hoping to be, and I believe that musically. I believe that musically that record would have been a spinoff for some amazing stuff to come, and that's what's frustrating. That's really frustrating.
You know, Yoko talks about that album. At the time, she told somebody that she wanted it as their first hello, and I thought, how strange to think about that as your first hello, because you're John and Yoko. I mean, you know, Two Virgins was your first hello. But no, they saw this as their...
No, it was because it was more, it was accepted. It was like musically it made sense, you know. And plus...
Caught up to Yoko, right?
Pardon me?
I mean, people caught up to Yoko.
Yeah. I think by that time they realized, you know, because John helped those matters by being, you know, this in the paper all the time, being the house husband and all that and doing things that John wanted to do.
I was listening to the B-52s, and I was thinking, like, Yoko didn't seem that strange.
No. She wouldn't have seemed strange to you. But, you know, you're not the average person, unfortunately.
Sorry.
I'm going to
jump around a bit, just because. Can you talk to me about, give me a paint a day in the life of the first rock and roll album in L.A. Give me a sense of... Paint the scene for me. Help me see what the studio is like and the interaction. You know, there's the very famous story of Phil Spector shooting up a gun.
The exaggerations of Phil's gun stuff in the studio anyway is I think it's pretty heavy, the exaggeration. And there will be people that may hear me say that and go, no, man, that wasn't exaggerated. I was there for whatever. The time, I can only speak to the times that I was there. And there was only one gun incident in my whole time with being with Phil and John and George and Ringo and all of that. I never saw a gun. He said, I never even saw the gun, but I heard, and I didn't hear the shot either. But I walked in the little lounge at Record Plant, and I saw Mal Evans up on his knee, up on the counter with a butter knife, trying to get the slug out of the ceiling, which was wood. It was a little wooden lounge, and so then it had become clear that what Phil had done was he'd shot at the floor, and bullet ricocheted up into the ceiling. And so the next thing I recall is that Chris Stone, the half-owner of the Record Plant, Gary Kellgren being the other half-owner, Chris came walking very seriously toward that area and said that everybody should get out and get out now. And don't come back either, by the way. And so we all left. And then the next thing that I heard was that the sessions were called for A&M. And so we were in the big room at A&M.
What were those sessions like? Paint for me that.
Like, sessions at A&M?
Well, not just the rock and roll. Well, give me a sense. You would come in with John? Would you pick John up?
Well, yeah, that's a good question. Yeah, it was a great one little funny incident. John and I rode together a couple of times, but most of the time May was driving him. And he came to our house a couple of times, and we'd start the session there. I mean, we'd start there by him, you know. John was the first person in my house that I bought in Las Feliz. We had moved, he came to the house on Maxwell Street to play me mind games. And then when we bought our house in Las Feliz, he came with May one night. We were out at a restaurant or something, and we said, you want to see the house we're buying? I said, you want to see the house you're helping me buy? And so we walked in, and there's no furniture in there, and we went out to the little patio in the front. He said, well, let's christen it. So we peed off the balcony into the ivy. And that was a nice little thing. And then after that, he came to the house, you know, later on, and we'd been living there a little bit, and he came upstairs one day and one night, he saw my big, gigantic Joe Cocker poster of Mad Dogs and Englishmen, you know, and he got down on his knees and he genuflected. He did all this stuff, you know, to Joe, and I have a picture of that, and I got some great pictures that night of him just being in the room, and he was just funny and great. And anyway, so we would go to the session, and one night I was driving a Corvette in those days, my 65 Daytona Blue Stingray, and he was riding in some rental car with May driving, and so we pulled up to right in front of that. The school that's down there, I wonder, you guys don't know what it's just right around here, it's right up the street here, on the way to A&M. I think we're on Bronson Street. Anyway, I pulled up to the stop sign, and she pulled up right next to me, and he was in the passenger side, so he was right here. And he said, here, and he handed me this jug of vodka. I've never seen it one since then that big. I guess they still make them. I thought of it as a joke. It was, you know, it had to be like a 5-gallon, you know, like a sparkless bottle size of vodka, Smirnoff, you know, the real shit. And like pulled it, handed it out the window to me. And I'm pulling this thing trying to get it through my window. And it's John. You know, I wouldn't have done this for anybody else in the world. I said, hey, you crazy, get the hell out of here with that. But it's John, so I'm going, I actually took a slug out of it and handed it back to him. And I think, you know, many times I think, oh, God, both of us would have been in jail, you know, just that easy. Anyway, so we get to the session, and John would have that thing sitting right next to him. He always had that massive bottle of vodka sitting there next to him, right next to his guitar. And then Phil would come in. Phil would show up, and Phil came in with different costumes at different times. One night he came in with a white butcher's coat on, with like fake blood or something. Maybe it was real blood. Who knows? It was crazy. But Phil, see, before Phil got messed up, earlier in the day when he was sober, Phil was like another Lenny Bruce. Phil was funny. Lenny Bruce was our hero in those days. And he had that kind of humor. He was funny, man. I wish people... It's so tragic what happened with Phil Spector. It's just so tragic that people couldn't know. You know, all they know is this crazy man. But anyway, Phil would come in. Phil would come in sober, and it was great. We did great stuff in the beginning of the night every time, but John would get drunker and drunker, and Phil would get drunker, and then we would all get drunker, and then pretty soon, it just wasn't anything happening except a big party, because guests would come all the time. You know, all the guests would come. A whole bunch of movie stars would come down. Different people would come and hang, and famous psychiatrists, and you know, all kinds of people.
I mean, but there was nothing really to take from those sessions in the end, right?
There was nothing to what?
Nothing to take from those sessions. They couldn't. They were
not, yeah, they used two or three songs, I think, on
the you're not going to get an album out of those sessions.
No, unfortunately, there wasn't an album to come out of that. That would have been that. No, because it just was too disjointed, too crazy. But but I always thought that was unfortunate because it started off. If somebody had had, if Phil had had a little more control, it could have been a brilliant record.
I want to ask you about the songs that John was playing. Did he ever talk to you about the rock and roll songs? Why he was choosing certain songs? Why these songs mattered to him? I mean, they weren't original. This is the first.
Well, he loved those songs for the same reason that we all love those songs. You know, they're just great. You know, Fats Domino, Little Richard, Chuck Berry. You got to love that music.
Those are the songs he grew up with.
Those are the songs that he grew up with. Same as Keith Richards and all those guys. You know, and that's why I say I learned most everything I know about rock and roll from John, George, Keith. And then reggae I certainly learned from Keith. You know, anyway, that's another long story. Keith,
okay. You did okay for yourself.
I did. I had great teachers, and then Ry Cooter, you know, filled in all the other blanks. You know, so yeah, I had some great teachers.
Elvis and Costello,
Hello,
roster. All right, but the last couple questions. When John comes back to New York for Mind Games, for Walls and Bridges.
Yeah.
Rock and roll.
Yeah.
Are those sessions, the Big Vodka, still there? Are those sessions the same in New York?
No.
Talk to me about.
No,
that.
It was completely different. Well, we, like I said before, we started at Morris Levy's ranch.
Let's talk about Walls and Bridges.
Walls and Bridges. Walls and Bridges was a fantastic record for me because I loved every song. And there was a moment that I love telling the story about Jimmy Iovine. Everybody knows who Jimmy Iovine is. He's probably the most powerful guy in the music business now. Well, at that time, he was little Jimmy who got me cigarettes and coffee at the beginning of the session. And Jimmy, to his credit, he loves a good laugh when I remind him about that. Even now, you know, he loves that. But there was a song we were going to do that day. I had heard the song, and it was called You Don't Know What You Got Until You Lose It. And I wanted that song to have again, this is John affecting me, and it still affects me to this day. I still love to hear something different every time I play, if I can. Unfortunately, it's not possible to do that. But anyway, this particular time, I said, I was hitting my drums. I was playing the snare drum and the tom, the rack tom, and I loved the way they sounded. They were very open and rattly, and I thought, wow, and it's right in tune with the song. The tom tom was, and so I thought, oh, geez. Jimmy happened to be standing. Jimmy Iovine. I think he had just asked me, hey Jimmy, you want coffee? And so I said, hey Jimmy. Go ask Shelley, and I think it was Shelley. I may be wrong about this. It was either Shelley or can't think of the other engineer's name. Why can't I ever think of the other engineer's name? Jesus. Not Nick. Oh, God. Can't ever think. Good. I'm glad you got all this. Shelley, okay, so I told Jimmy, go tell Shelley that I want to get this sound. I want to, don't be surprised, but I want to hit the snare drum and it's going to be clangy, it's going to ring, and the tom as well. I'm not going to have any padding, anything. I'm going to take the wallet off and all that. It's not going to sound like the normal sound that we usually get. And ask him if it's cool because I really like the way it sounds right now. So Jimmy goes, leave it to me. And went in the room, we cut the track, and to this very day, as we speak right now, it's one of my very favorite songs of all time, because I just love the sound, the attitude with which John was singing that song. And you know, we all know what he was singing about, and everything about it. It just, it was great. And Jesse Ed's guitar was just killing.
Did John notice that you had done that?
Pardon me?
Did John notice that you had done that?
I told John, yeah. I told John, you know, either right after that or something. I told John. Yeah.
His response?
Well, he loved it. I mean, John was the reason why I did it, you know. When I look back, I had no other reason to think about, you know, that there should be a sound that could be different from the norm, you know, because I was a studio guy and I just wanted to sound like Hal Blaine and Earl Palmer. That's all I wanted to do. And with John, by virtue of the Beatle records with all those great sounds, you know, that they used to get, I heard what he was saying, and that's what I wanted to do. John, you know, everybody knows that John used to tell Jeff Emmerich, the engineer, I don't want my guitar to sound like a guitar. You know, do something different. And so those guys were always looking around for trying to figure ways to make things happen. Anyway, that was my little version of doing that with Shelley on that record. And so that was a very momentous thing for me.
I want to read something to you and just get a sense of what you remember when you heard this and what where you were, or just what you still think. This is how most of the country heard: an unspeakable tragedy confirmed to us by ABC News in New York City. John Lennon outside of his apartment building on the west side of New York City, the most famous perhaps of all the Beatles, shot twice in the back, rushed to Roosevelt Hospital, dead on arrival.
I was at a recording session with Harry Nilsson and Jesse Ed, and Harry was producing Sly Stallone's brother, Frank Stallone. Anyway, and you know, it just stopped us dead in our tracks. I remember Jesse couldn't speak, and he disappeared. And I said, "What? Where did anybody see Jesse?" And they said he took off in the car. There was a limo that had brought him to the session, and he just took off in it. And so I never knew where he went. That night, I don't remember anything after that night. I don't know what I did. It wasn't good, probably, with Harry. We probably went to some bars. I really don't know, and I never asked Harry what we did. But I remember that I called home, and Cynthia was crying and going, "It can't be true. It's not true." And that's kind of all I remember. It just didn't seem real. And then later, you know, like the next day or later that night or something, it was on perpetually, you know, on TV, and then they would show the Dakota, and there was the room that I stayed right there on the corner, and they're describing the walk up to the elevator, and that's exactly where I walked, and all this stuff is playing in my head, and then. The really, really awful part was when I heard a report that he didn't go in an ambulance to the hospital. He rode in the back of a cop car, you know, squad car, just took him right away, you know, so that they could save him. And he was in the back, and the officer could hear him gurgling and trying to say something. And that still gives me chills to this day. I mean, I'm thinking of this powerful, great force called John Lennon, laying there dying in the back of a squad car, with, you know, trying to probably breathe, and he's got blood all up in his lungs, and those slugs are in there, and it's very, very, very. It's just so hard to imagine, and why, and all of that, but
There really is no why.
You know, those kinds of things, there's just no answer to it. It's just like a lot of things in life, there are no answers to those kinds of things. And in Yoko, I was crying so hard the other day. We did this show in Brooklyn.
I was there. I saw
yeah? I was the film, watching the film, I was crying so much. A lot of people were crying in the audience, you know, just reliving that that time. And then she sang her little song. Then she sang that song about it. And it just rip your heart out, because to be her, it's bad enough to be us, friends of John, fans of John, but to be, you know, Yoko. And Sean was very little, but, you know, just imagine him now, you know. I mean, the hurt must be just tremendous. It's beyond hurt, you know. That's why I think it's good that Sean is out doing what he's doing, and that Yoko is actually out performing and doing all the stuff. It's got to be cathartic to some.
When somebody says, John, or the birthday comes around, or the anniversary, you know, this year is going to be, he would have been 70 this October. This December,
yeah.
It'll be 30.
Wow,
years.
That's right.
What do you think? How do you remember him? What do you carry with you in your pocket? What do you carry with you of John? What is your... Is it loss? Is it a sense of humor? Is it a sense of placement? What is it that you carry with you?
I think truly that I carry with me from John is thinking patterns. I think that I believe and think certain things that I never would have without John. I know that John changed my mind about this, about that, about so many different things, just from reading interviews and stuff. And this was well before I met him. After I met him, he just was like a guy, but like a great guy, a great, powerful force of a guy who... to answer your question, I think that's what it is. I think that the way I feel about a lot of ordinary things in life, those things directly go to John. And the way I feel about the sounds of drums, sounds of guitars, listen to Revolution number 9, man. Listen to that again and tell me that's not just... He always wanted for it to make his record sound as unique as Heartbreak Hotel, Elvis Presley. And so, you know, he was always after that. And this is for him to be so early in my life, you know, like that. I think that changed me forever. There's so many things, in other words, about the way I feel about things in life. That's what I carry of John Lennon's. John was hugely influential to me. Just like Bob Dylan, it's another story at another time, but Bob equally in a totally different way, in another arena. But John, just, I think early on, just shaped my thinking about a lot of stuff. And that's what I will, you know, that's the way I, if I need to remember John, I do remember John a lot of times when I'm thinking about something. I think, oh, wow. That's what John used to do or say, and that's why I'm doing this or saying it or whatever. So, yeah.